can kill a lion, but a dragon is a different sort of beast. I would sooner be the dragon's friend. She tried the ring on her finger. It was too big even for her thumb. Dragon or no, I must have Bennis of the Brown Shield. No. You are 7 feet of stubborn, less an inch. She gave him back the ring. I cannot return to Coldmoat empty-handed. They will say the Red Widow has lost her bite, that she was too weak to do justice, that she could not protect her small folk. You do not understand, sir. I might. Better than you know. I remember once some little lord in the Stormlands took Sir Arlan into service to help him fight some other little lord. When I asked the old man what they were fighting over, he said, "Nothing, lad. It's just some pissing contest." Lady Rohan gave him a shocked look, but could sustain it no more than half a heartbeat before it turned into a grin. "I have heard 1,000 empty courtesies in my time, but you are the first knight who ever said pissing in my presence." Her freckled face went somber. "Those pissing contests are how lords judge one another's strength, and woe to any man who shows his weakness. A woman must needs piss twice as hard if she hopes to rule, and if that woman should happen to be small. Lord Stackhouse covets my Horseshoe Hills. Sir Clifford Conklin has an old claim to Leafy Lake. Those dismal Durwells live by stealing cattle, and beneath mine own roof I have the Long Inch. Every day I wake wondering if this might be the day he marries me by force." Her hand curled tight around her braid, as hard as if it were a rope, and she was dangling over a precipice. "He wants to, I know. He holds back for fear of my wrath, just as Conklin and Stackhouse and the Durwells tread carefully where the Red Widow is concerned. If any of them thought for a moment that I had turned weak and soft..." Dunk put the ring back on his finger and drew his dagger. The widow's eyes went wide at the sight of naked steel. "What are you doing?" she said. "Have you lost your wits? There are 12 crossbows trained on you." "You wanted blood for blood." He laid the dagger against his cheek. "They told you wrong. It wasn't Bennis cut that digger. It was me." He pressed the edge of the steel into his face, slashed downward. When he shook the blood off the blade, some spattered on her face. More freckles, he thought. "There, the Red Widow has her due. A cheek for a cheek." "You are quite mad." The smoke had filled her eyes with tears. "If you were better born, I'd marry you." "Aye, m'lady, and if pigs had wings and scales and breathed flame, they'd be as good as dragons." Dunk slid the knife back in its sheath. His face had begun to throb. The blood ran down his cheek and dripped onto his gorget. The smell made Thunder snort and pour the water. "Give me the men who burned the wood." "No one burned the wood," she said. "But if some man of mine had done so, it must have been to please me. How could I give such a man to you?" She glanced back at her escort. "It would be best if Sir Eustace were just to withdraw his accusation."
"Those pigs will be breathing fire first, m'lady."
"In that case, I must assert my innocence before the eyes of gods and men. Tell Sir Eustace that I demand an apology or a trial. The choice is his." She wheeled her horse about to ride back to her men.
Bran. The hunt left at dawn. The king wanted wild boar at the feast tonight. Prince Joffrey rode with his father, so Robert had been allowed to join the hunters as well. Uncle Benjen, Jory, Theon Greyjoy, Sir Roderick, and even the Queen's funny little brother had all ridden out with them. It was the last hunt, after all. On the morrow, they left for the south. Bran had been left behind with John and the girls and Rickon. But Rickon was only a baby, and the girls were only girls, and John and his wolf were nowhere to be found. Bran did not look for him very hard. He thought John was angry at him. John seemed angry with everyone these days. Bran did not know why. He was going with Uncle Ben to the wall to join the night's watch. That was almost as good as going south for the king. Rob was the one they were leaving behind, not John. For days, Bran could scarcely wait to be off. He was going to ride the king's road on a horse of his own. Not a pony, but a real horse. His father would be the hand of the king, and they were going to live in the Red Castle at King's Landing. the castle the dragon lords had built. Old Nan said there were ghosts there and dungeons where terrible things had been done and dragon heads on the walls. It gave Bran a shiver just to think of it, but he was not afraid. How could he be afraid? His father would be with him, and the king and all his knights and sworn swords. Bran was going to be a knight himself some day, one of the king's guard. Old Nan said they were the finest swords in all the realm. There were only 7 of them, and they wore white armour and had no wives or children, but lived only to serve the king. Bran knew all the stories. Their names were like music to him. Serwyn of the Mirror Shield, Sir Ryman Redwine, Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, the twins Sir Eric and Sir Arik, who had died on one another's swords hundreds of years ago, when brother fought sister in the war the singers called the Dance of the Dragons, the White Bull Gerard Hightower, Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning, Barristan the Bold. 2 of the king's guards had come north with King Robert. Bran had watched them with fascination, never quite daring to speak to them. Sir Boris was a bald man with a jowly face. Sir Meron had droopy eyes and a beard the colour of rust. Sir Jaime Lannister looked more like the knights in the stories, and he was of the king's guard too. But Rob said he had killed the old mad king and shouldn't count any more. The greatest living knight was Sir Barristan Selmy, Barristan the Bold, the Lord Commander of the King's Guard. Father had promised that they would meet Sir Barristan when they reached King's Landing, and Bran had been marking the days on his wall, eager to depart, to see a world he had only dreamed of, and begin a life he could scarcely imagine. Yet now that the last day was at hand, suddenly Bran felt lost. Winterfell had been the only home he'd ever known. His father had told him that he ought to say his farewells today, and he had tried. After the hunt had ridden out, he wandered through the castle with his wolf at his side, intending to visit the ones who would be left behind. Old Nan, and Gage the cook, Micken in his smithy, Hodor, the stable boy, who smiled so much and took care of his pony, and never said anything but, "Hodor," the man in the glass garden who gave him a blackberry when he came to visit. But it was no good. He had gone to the stable first and seen his pony there in its stall, except it wasn't his pony any more. He was getting a real horse and leaving the pony behind. And all of a sudden, Bran just wanted to sit down and cry. He turned and ran off before Hodar and the other stable boys could see the tears in his eyes. That was the end of his farewells. Instead, Bran spent the morning alone in the guard's wood, trying to teach his wolf to fetch a stick, and failing. The wolfling was smarter than any of the hounds in his father's kennels, and Bran would have sworn he understood every word that was said to him, but he showed little interest in chasing sticks. He was still trying to decide on a name. Rob was calling his Grey Wind, because he ran so fast. Sansa had named hers Lady, and Arya named hers after some old witch queen in the songs, and little Rickon called his Shaggy Dog, which Bran thought was a pretty stupid name for a direwolf. John's wolf, the white one, was Ghost. Bran wished he had thought of that first, even though his wolf wasn't white. He had tried 100 names in the last fortnight, but none of them sounded right. Finally, he got tired of the stick game and decided to go climbing. He hadn't been up in the Broken Tower for weeks with everything that had happened, and this might be his last chance. He raced across the Guardswood, taking the long way around to avoid the pool where the heart tree grew. The heart tree had always frightened him. Trees ought not to have eyes, Bran thought, or leaves that look like hands. His wolf came sprinting at his heel. "You stay here," he told him. At the base of the sentinel tree near the armory wall. "Lie down. That's right, now stay." The wolf did as he was told. Bran scratched him behind the ears, then turned away, jumped, grabbed a low branch, and pulled himself up. He was halfway up the tree, moving easily from limb to limb, when the wolf got to his feet and began to howl. Bran looked back down. His wolf fell silent, staring up at him through slitted yellow eyes. A strange chill went through him. He began to climb again. Once more the wolf howled. "Quiet!" he yelled. "Sit down! Stay! You're worse than mother!" The howling chased him all the way up the tree, until finally he jumped off onto the armory roof and out of sight. The rooftops at Winterfell were Bran's second home. His mother often said that Bran could climb before he could walk. Bran could not remember when he first learned to walk, but he could not remember when he first started to climb either, so he supposed it must be true. To a boy, Winterfell was a grey stone labyrinth of walls and towers and courtyards and tunnels spreading in all directions. In the older parts of the castle, the hall slanted up and down, so that you couldn't be sure what floor you were on. The place had grown over the centuries like some monstrous stone tree, Maester Lewin told him once, and its branches were gnarled and thick and twisted, its roots sunk deep into the earth. When he got out from under it and scrambled up near the sky, Bran could see all of Winterfell in a glance. He liked the way it looked, spread out beneath him, only birds wheeling over his head, while all the life of the castle went on below. Bran could perch for hours amongst the shapeless, rain-worn gargoyles that brooded over the first keep, watching it all. The men drilling with wood and steel in the yard, the cooks tending their vegetables in the glass garden, restless dogs running back and forth in the kennels, the silence of the guard's wood, the girls gossiping beside the washing well. It made him feel like he was lord of the castle in a way even Rob would never know. It taught him Winterfell's secrets, too. The builders had not even leveled the earth. There were hills and valleys behind the walls of Winterfell. There was a covered bridge that went from the fourth floor of the bell tower across to the second floor of the rookery. Bran knew about that, and he knew that you could get inside the inner wall by the south gate, climb three floors, and run all the way around Winterfell through a narrow tunnel in the stone, and then come out on ground level at the north gate, with 100 feet of wall looming over you. Even Maester Lewin didn't know that, Bran was convinced. His mother was terrified that one day Bran would slip off a wall and kill himself. He told her that he wouldn't, but she never believed him. Once she had made him promise that he would stay on the ground. He had managed to keep that promise for almost a fortnight, miserable every day, until one night he had gone out of the window of his bedroom when his brothers were fast asleep. He confessed his crime the next day in a fit of guilt. Lord Eddard ordered him to the Godswood to cleanse himself. Guards were posted to see that Bran remained there alone all night to reflect on his disobedience. The next morning, Bran was nowhere to be seen. They finally found him fast asleep in the upper branches of the tallest sentinel in the grove. As angry as he was, his father could not help but laugh. "You're not my son," he told Bran when they fetched him down. "You're a squirrel." "So be it. If you must climb, then climb, but try not to let your mother see you." Bran did his best, although he did not think he ever really fooled her. Since his father would not forbid it, she turned to others. Old Nan told him a story about a bad little boy who climbed too high and was struck down by lightning, and how afterwards the crows came to peck out his eyes. Bran was not impressed. There were crows' nests atop the broken tower, where no one ever went but him, and sometimes he filled his pockets with corn before he climbed up there, and the crows ate it right out of his hand. None of them had ever shown the slightest bit of interest in pecking out his eyes. Later, Maester Lewin built a little pottery boy and dressed him in Bran's clothes and flung him off the wall into the yard below to demonstrate what would happen to Bran if he fell. That had been fun, but afterwards Bran just looked at the maester and said, "I'm not made of clay, and anyhow, I never fall." Then for a while the guards would chase him whenever they saw him on the roofs and try to haul him down. That was the best time of all. It was like playing a game with his brothers, except that Bran always won. None of the guards could climb half as well as Bran, not even Jorry. Most of the time they never saw him anyway. People never looked up. That was another thing he liked about climbing. It was almost like being invisible. He liked how it felt, too, pulling himself up a wall, stone by stone, fingers and toes digging hard into the small crevices between. He always took off his boots and went barefoot when he climbed. It made him feel as if he had four hands instead of two. He liked the deep, sweet ache it left in the muscles afterwards. He liked the way the air tasted way up high, sweet and cold as a winter peach. He liked the birds, the crows in the broken tower, the little sparrows that nested in cracks between the stones, the ancient owl that slept in the dusty loft above the old armory. Bran knew them all. Most of all, he liked going places that no one else could go, and seeing the grey sprawl of Winterfell in a way that no one else ever saw it. It made the whole castle Bran's secret place. His favourite haunt was a broken tower. Once had been a watchtower, the tallest in Winterfell. A long time ago, 100 years before even his father had been born, a lightning strike had set it afire. The top third of the structure had collapsed inward, and the tower had never been rebuilt. Sometimes his father sent ratters into the base of the tower to clean out the nests they always found among the jumble of fallen stones and charred and rotten beams. But no one ever got up to the jagged top of the structure now, except Bran and the crows. He knew two ways to get there. You could climb straight up the side of the tower itself, but the stones were loose, the mortar that held them together long gone to ash, and Bran never liked to put his full weight on them. The best way was to start from the godswood, shinny up the tall sentinel, and cross over the armory and the guards' hall, leaping roof to roof, barefoot, so the guards wouldn't hear you overhead. That brought you up to the blind side of the first keep, the oldest part of the castle, a squat round fortress that was taller than it looked. Only rats and spiders live there now, but the old stones still made for good climbing. You could go straight up to where the gargoyles leaned out blindly over empty space, and swing from gargoyle to gargoyle, hand over hand, around to the north side. From there, if you really stretched, you could reach out and pull yourself over to the broken tower where it leaned close. The last part was a scramble up the blackened stones to the eyrie, no more than 10 feet, and then the crows would come round to see if you'd brought any corn. Bran was moving from gargoyle to gargoyle with the ease of long practice when he heard the voices. He was so startled, he almost lost his grip. The first keep had been empty all his life. "I do not like it," a woman was saying. There was a row of windows beneath him, and the voice was drifting out of the last window in his side. "You should be the hand." "Gods forbid," a man's voice replied lazily. "It's not an honour I'd want. There's far too much work involved." Bran hung, listening, suddenly afraid to go on. They might glimpse his feet if he tried to swing by. "Don't you see the danger this puts us in?" the woman said. "Robert loves the man like a brother." "Robert can barely stomach his brothers. Not that I blame him. Stannis would be enough to give anyone indigestion." "Oh, don't play the fool. Stannis and Renly are one thing, and Eddard Stark is quite another. Robert will listen to Stark." "Damn them both. I should have insisted that he name you, but I was certain Stark would refuse him." "We ought to count ourselves fortunate," the man said. "The king might easily have named one of his brothers, or even Littlefinger. Gods help us. Give me honourable enemies rather than ambitious ones, and I'll sleep more easily by night." They were talking about father, Bran realized. He wanted to hear more, a few more feet, but they would see him if he swung out in front of the window. "We will have to watch him carefully," the woman said. "I would sooner watch you," the man said. He sounded bored. "Come back here." "Lord Eddard has never taken any interest in anything that happens south of the Neck," the woman said. "Never, I tell you. He means to move against us. Why else would he leave the seat of his power?" "A 100 reasons, duty, honour. He yearns to write his name large across the book of history, to get away from his wife, or both. Perhaps he just wants to be warm for once in his life. His wife is Lady Aaron's sister. It's a wonder Lysa was not here to greet us with her accusations. Bran looked down. There was a narrow ledge beneath the window, only a few inches wide. He tried to lower himself toward it. Too far. He would never reach.
You fret too much. Lysa Aaron is a frightened cow.
That frightened cow shared John Aaron's bed.
But if she knew anything, she would have gone to Robert before she fled King's Landing.
When he had already agreed to foster that weakling son of hers at Casterly Rock, I think not. She knew the boy's life would be hostage to her silence. She may grow bolder now that he's safe atop the Eyrie.
Mothers!
The man made the word sound like a curse.
I think birthing does something to your mind. You're all mad.
He laughed. It was a bitter sound.
Let Lady Aaron grow as bold as she likes. Whatever she knows, whatever she thinks she knows, she has no proof. He paused a moment. Or does she?
Do you think the king will require proof? The woman said. I tell you, he loves me not.
And whose fault is that, sweet sister?
Bran studied the ledge. He could drop down. It was too narrow to land on, but if he could catch hold as he fell past, pull himself up. Except that might make a noise, draw them to the window. He was not sure what he was hearing, but he knew it was not meant for his ears.
You are as blind as Robert, the woman was saying. If you mean I see the same thing, the man said, I see a man who would sooner die than betray his king.
He betrayed one already, or have you forgotten? The woman said. Oh, I don't deny he's loyal to Robert, that's obvious. What happens when Robert dies and Joff takes the throne? And the sooner that comes to pass, the safer we'll all be. My husband grows more restless every day. Having Stark beside him will only make him worse. He's still in love with the sister, the insipid little dead 16-year-old. How long till he decides to put me aside for some new Lyanna? Bran was suddenly very frightened. He wanted nothing so much as to go back the way he had come, to find his brothers. Only what would he tell them? He had to get closer, Bran realized. He had to see who was talking. The man sighed.
You should think less about the future and more about the pleasures at hand.
Stop that, the woman said. Bran heard the sudden slap of flesh on flesh, then the man's laughter. Bran pulled himself up, climbed over the gargoyle, crawled out along the roof. This was the easy way. He moved across the roof to the next gargoyle, right above the window of the room where they were talking.
All this talk is getting very tiresome, sister, the man said. Come here and be quiet.
Bran sat astride the gargoyle, tightening his legs around it, and swung himself around upside down. He hung by his legs and slowly stretched his head down toward the window. The world seemed strange upside down. A courtyard swam dizzily below him, its stones still wet with melted snow. Bran looked in the window. Inside the room, a man and a woman were wrestling. They were both naked. Bran could not tell who they were. The man's back was to him, and his body screened the woman from view as he pushed her up against a wall. There were soft, wet sounds. Bran realized they were kissing. He watched, wide-eyed and frightened, his breath tight in his throat. The man had a hand down between her legs, and he must have been hurting her there, because the woman started to moan, low in her throat.
Stop it, she said. Stop it. Stop it, please.
But her voice was low and weak, and she did not push him away. Her hands buried themselves in his hair, his tangled golden hair, and pulled his face down to her breast. Bran saw her face. Her eyes were closed, and her mouth was open, moaning. Her golden hair swung from side to side as her head moved back and forth, but still he recognized the queen. He must have made a noise,
Suddenly her eyes opened, and she was staring right at him. She screamed. Everything happened at once then. The woman pushed the man away wildly, shouting and pointing. Bran tried to pull himself up, bending double as he reached for the gargoyle. He was in too much of a hurry. His hand scraped uselessly across the smooth stone, and in his panic his leg slipped, and suddenly he was falling. There was an instant of vertigo, a sickening lurch as the window flashed past. He shut out a hand, grabbed for the ledge, lost it, caught it again with his other hand. He swung against the building hard. The impact took the breath out of him. Bran dangled, one-handed, panting. Faces appeared in the window above him. The Queen. And now Bran recognized the man beside her. They looked as much alike as reflections in a mirror. "He saw us," the woman said shrilly.
"So he did," the man said.
Brian's finger started to slip. He grabbed the ledge with his other hand. Fingernails dug into the unyielding stone. The man reached down.
"Take my hand," he said, "before you fall."
Bran seized his arm and held on tight with all his strength. The man yanked him up to the ledge.
"What are you doing?" the woman demanded.
The man ignored her. He was very strong. He stood Bran up on the sill.
"How old are you, boy?"
Seven, Bran said, shaking with relief. His fingers had dug deep gouges in the man's forearm. He let go sheepishly. The man looked over at the woman.
"The things I do for love," he said, with loathing.
He gave Bran a shove. Screaming, Bran fell backward out of the window into empty air. There was nothing to grab onto. The courtyard rushed up to meet him. Somewhere in the distance, a wolf was howling. Crows circled the broken tower, waiting for corn.
Daenerys. Across the still blue water came the slow, steady beat of drums and the slow swish of oars from the galleys. The great cog groaned in their wake, the heavy line stretched taut between. Valyrian sails hung limp, drooping forlorn from the masts, yet even so, as she stood upon the forecastle, watching her dragons chase each other across a cloudless blue sky, Daenerys Targaryen was as happy as she could ever remember being. Her Dothraki called the sea the poison water, distrusting any liquid that their horses could not drink. On the day the three ships had lifted anchor at Carth, you would have thought they were sailing to hell instead of Pentos. Her brave young blood riders had stared off at the dwindling coastline with huge white eyes, each of the three determined to show no fear before the other two, while her handmaids, Iri and Jiqui, clutched the rail desperately and retched over the side at every little swell. The rest of Dany's tiny Khalasar remained below decks, preferring the company of their nervous horses to the terrifying landless world about the ships. When a sudden squall had enveloped them, 6 days into the voyage, she heard them through the hatches, the horses kicking and screaming, the riders praying in thin, quavery voices each time Valyrian heaved or swayed. No squall could frighten Dany, though. Daenerys Stormborn, she was called, for she had come howling into the world on distant Dragonstone as the greatest storm in the memory of Westeros howled outside, a storm so fierce that it ripped gargoyles from the castle walls and smashed her father's fleet to kindling. The narrow sea was often stormy, and Dany had crossed it 50 times as a girl, running from one free city to the next, half a step ahead of the usurper's hard knives. She loved the sea. She liked the sharp, salty smell of the air, and the vastness of horizons bounded only by a vault of azure sky above. It made her feel small, but free as well. She liked the dolphins that sometimes swam along beside Valyrian, slicing through the waves like silvery spears, and the flying fish they glimpsed now and again. She even liked the sailors, all their songs and stories. Once on a voyage to Braavos, as she watched the crew wrestle down a great green sail in a rising gale,
She had even thought how fine it would be to be a sailor. But when she told her brother, Viserys had twisted her hair until she cried. "You are blood of the dragon," he had screamed at her. "A dragon, not some smelly fish." He was a fool about that, and so much else, Danny thought. If he had been wiser and more patient, it would be him sailing west to take the throne that was his by rights. Viserys had been stupid and vicious, she had come to realize, yet sometimes she missed him all the same. Not the cruel, weak man he had become by the end, but the brother who had sometimes let her creep into his bed, the boy who told her tales of the Seven Kingdoms and talked of how much better their lives would be once he claimed his crown. The captain appeared at her elbow.
"Would that this Balerion could soar as her namesake did, Your Grace,"
he said in bastard Valerian, heavily flavoured with accents of Pentos.
"Then we should not need to row, nor tow, nor pray for wind."
"Just so, Captain," she answered with a smile, pleased to have won the man over. Captain Grelio was an old Pentoshi, like his master, Illyrio Mopatis, and he had been nervous as a maiden about carrying three dragons on his ship. Half a 100 buckets of seawater still hung from the gunwales in case of fires. At first Grelio had wanted the dragons caged, and Danny had consented to put his fears at ease. But their misery was so palpable that she soon changed her mind and insisted they be freed. Even Captain Grelio was glad of that now. There had been one small fire, easily extinguished. Against that, Balerion suddenly seemed to have far fewer rats than she'd had before when she sailed under the name Sedulian. And her crew, once as fearful as they were curious, had begun to take a queer, fierce pride in their dragons. Every man of them, from captain to cook's boy, loved to watch the three fly, though none so much as Danny. "They are my children," she told herself, "and if the Magi spoke truly, they are the only children I'm ever like to have." The Syrian scales were the colour of fresh cream, his horns, wing bones, and spinal crest a dark gold that flashed bright as metal in the sun. Rhaegal was made of the green of summer and the bronze of fall. They soared above the ships in wide circles, higher and higher, each trying to climb above the other. Dragons always preferred to attack from above, Danny had learned. Should either get between the other and the sun, he would fold his wings and dive screaming, and they would tumble from the sky, locked together in a tangled scaly ball, jaws snapping and tails lashing. The first time they had done it, she feared that they meant to kill each other. But it was only sport. No sooner would they splash into the sea than they would break apart and rise again, shrieking and hissing, the salt water steaming off them as their wings clawed at the air. Drogon was aloft as well, though not in sight. He would be miles ahead, or miles behind, hunting. He was always hungry, her Drogon. Hungry and growing fast. Another year, or perhaps two, and he may be large enough to ride. Then I shall have no need of ships to cross the great salt sea. But that time was not yet come. Rhaegal and Viserion were the size of small dogs. Drogon only a little larger, and any dog would have outweighed them. They were all wings and neck and tail, lighter than they looked. And so Daenerys Targaryen must rely on wood and wind and canvas to bear her home. The wood and the canvas had served her well enough so far, but the fickle wind had turned traitor. For 6 days and 6 nights they had been becalmed, and now a seventh day had come, and still no breath of air to fill their sails. Fortunately, two of the ships that Magister Illyrio had sent after her were trading galleys, with 200 oars apiece and crews of strong-armed oarsmen to row them. But the great cog Balerion was a song of a different key, a ponderous, broad-beam sow of a ship with immense holes and huge sails but helpless in a calm. Vhagar and Maraxes had let out lines to tow her, but it made for painfully slow going. All three ships were crowded and heavily laden.
"I cannot see Drogon," said Sir Jorah Mormont, as he joined her on the forecastle. "Is he lost again?"
"We are the ones who are lost, sir. Drogon has no taste for this wet creeping, no more than I do." Bolder than the other two, her black dragon had been the first to try his wings above the water, the first to flutter from ship to ship, the first to lose himself in a passing cloud, and the first to kill. The flying fish no sooner broke the surface of the water than they were enveloped in a lance of flame, snatched up and swallowed. "How big will he grow?" Danny asked curiously. "Do you know?"
"In the Seven Kingdoms there are tales of dragons who grew so huge that they could pluck giant krakens from the sea."
Danny laughed. "That would be a wondrous sight to see."
"It is only a tale, Khaleesi," said her exile knight. "They talk of wise old dragons living 1,000 years as well."
"Well, how long does a dragon live?" She looked up as Viserion swooped low over the ship, his wings beating slowly and stirring the limp sails. Sir Jorah shrugged.
"A dragon's natural span of days is many times as long as a man's, or so the songs would have us believe, but the dragons the Seven Kingdoms knew best were those of House Targaryen. They were bred for war, and in war they died. It is no easy thing to slay a dragon, but it can be done."
The squire, Whitebeard, standing by the figurehead with one lean hand curled about his tall hardwood staff, turned toward them and said,
"Beleriand the Black Dread was 200 years old when he died during the reign of Jaehaerys the Conciliator. He was so large he could swallow an oryx whole. A dragon never stops growing, Your Grace, so long as he has food and freedom."
His name was Arstan, but Strong Belwas had named him Whitebeard for his pale whiskers, and most everyone called him that now. He was taller than Sir Jorah, but not so muscular. His eyes were a pale blue, his long beard as white as snow and as fine as silk. "Freedom?" asked Danny, curious. "What do you mean?"
"In King's Landing, your ancestors raised an immense domed castle for their dragons. The Dragon Pit, it is called. It still stands atop the Hill of Rhaenys, though all in ruins now. That was where the royal dragons dwelt in days of yore, and a cavernous dwelling it was, with iron doors so wide the 30 knights could ride through them abreast. Yet even so, it was noted that none of the pit dragons ever reached the size of their ancestors. The maesters say it was because of the walls around them and the great dome above their heads."
"If walls could keep us small, peasants would all be tiny and kings as large as giants," said Sir Jorah. "I've seen huge men born in hovels and dwarfs who dwelt in castles."
"Men are men," Whitebeard replied. "Dragons are dragons."
Sir Jorah snorted his disdain.
"How profound."
The exile knight had no love for the old man. He'd made that plain from the first.
"What do you know of dragons, anyway?"
"Little enough, that's true. Yet I served for a time in King's Landing in the days when King Aerys sat the Iron Throne and walked beneath the dragon skulls that looked down from the walls of his throne room."
"Viserys talked of those skulls," said Danny. "The usurper took them down and hid them away. He could not bear them looking down on him upon his stolen throne." She beckoned Whitebeard closer. "Did you ever meet my royal father? King Aerys II had died before his daughter was born."
I had that great honor, Your Grace.
Did you find him good and gentle? Whitebeard did his best to hide his feelings, but they were there, plain on his face.
His Grace was often pleasant.
Often, Danny smiled, but not always.
He could be very harsh to those he thought his enemies.
A wise man never makes an enemy of a king, Danny said. Did you know my brother Rhaegar as well?
It was said that no man ever knew Prince Rhaegar, truly. I had the privilege of seeing him in Tourney, though, and often heard him play his harp with its silver strings.
Sir Jorah snorted.
Along with 1,000 others, at some harvest feast. Next you'll claim you squired for him.
I make no such claim, sir. Miles Mouton was Prince Rhaegar's squire, and Richard Longmouth after him. When they won their spurs, he knighted them himself, and they remained his close companions. Young Lord Cunningham was dear to the prince as well, but his oldest friend was Arthur Dane.
The Sword of the Morning, said Danny, delighted. Viserys used to talk about his wondrous white blade. He said Sir Arthur was the only knight in the realm who was our brother's peer. Whitebeard bowed his head.
It is not my place to question the words of Prince Viserys.
King, Danny corrected. He was a king, though he never reigned. Viserys the third of his name. But what do you mean? His answer had not been one she'd expected. Sir Jorah named Rhaegar the last dragon once. He had to have been a peerless warrior to be called that, surely.
Your Grace, said Whitebeard, the Prince of Dragonstone was a most puissant warrior, but...
Go on, she urged. You may speak freely to me.
As you command.
The old man leaned upon his hardwood staff, his brow furrowed.
A warrior without a peer. Those are fine words, Your Grace, but words win no battles.
Swords win battles, Sir Jorah said bluntly, and Prince Rhaegar knew how to use one.
He did, sir, but I have seen 100 tournaments and more wars than I would wish, and however strong or fast or skilled a knight may be, there are others who can match him. A man will win one tourney and fall quickly in the next. A slick spot in the grass may mean defeat, or what you ate for supper the night before. A change in the wind may bring the gift of victory.
He glanced at Sir Jorah.
Or a lady's favour knotted round an arm.
Mormont's face darkened.
Be careful what you say, old man.
Arston had seen Sir Jorah fight at Lannisport, Danny knew. In the tourney, Mormont had won with a lady's favour knotted round his arm. He had won the lady, too. Lyness of House Hightower, his second wife, high-born and beautiful. But she had ruined him and abandoned him, and the memory of her was bitter to him now. Be gentle, my knight. She put a hand on Jorah's arm. Arston has no wish to give offence, I'm certain.
The less you say, Khaleesi.
Sir Jorah's voice was grudging. Danny turned back to the squire. I know little of Rhaegar, only the tales Viserys told, and he was a little boy when our brother died. What was he truly like? The old man considered for a moment.
Able, that above all. Determined, deliberate, dutiful, single-minded. There is a tale told of him, but doubtless Sir Jorah knows it as well.
I would hear it from you.
As you wish, said Whitebeard. As a young boy, the Prince of Dragonstone was bookish to a fault. He was reading so early that men said Queen Rhaella must have swallowed some books and a candle whilst he was in her womb. Rhaegar took no interest in the play of other children. The maesters were awed by his wits, but his father's knights would jest sourly that Baelor the Blessed had been born again. Until, one day, Prince Rhaegar found something in his scrolls that changed him. No one knows what it might have been, only that the boy suddenly appeared early one morning in the yard as the knights were donning their steel. He walked up to Sir William Derry, the master at arms, and said, "I will require sword and armour. It seems I must be a warrior."
"And he was," said Danny, delighted.
"He was, indeed."
Whitebeard bowed.
"My pardon, Your Grace. We speak of warriors, and I see the strong Belwis has arisen. I must attend him."
Danny glanced aft. The eunuch was climbing through the hold amidships, nimble for all his size. Belwas was squat but broad, a good 15 stone of fat and muscle, his great brown gut crisscrossed by faded white scars. He wore baggy pants, a yellow silk belly band, and an absurdly tiny leather vest dotted with iron studs.
"Strong Belwas is hungry," he roared at everyone, and no one in particular. "Strong Belwas will eat now."
Turning, he spied Arsten on the forecastle.
"Whitebeard, you will bring food for Strong Belwas."
"You may go," Danny told the squire. He bowed again and moved off to tend the needs of the man he served. Sir Jorah watched with a frown on his blunt, honest face. Mormont was big and burly, strong of jaw and thick of shoulder. Not a handsome man by any means, but as true a friend as Danny had ever known.
"You would be wise to take that old man's words well salted," he told her when Whitebeard was out of earshot.
A queen must listen to all, she reminded him. The high-born and the low, the strong and the weak, the noble and the venal. One voice may speak you false, but in many there is always truth to be found. She had read that in a book.
"Hear my voice, then, Your Grace," the exile said. "This Arsten Whitebeard is playing you false. He is too old to be a squire, and too well-spoken to be serving that oaf of a eunuch."
"That does seem queer," Danny had to admit. Strong Belwas was an ex-slave, bred and trained in the fighting pits of Meereen. Magister Illyrio had sent him to guard her, or so Belwas claimed, and it was true that she needed guarding. The usurper on his iron throne had offered land and lordship to any man who killed her. One attempt had been made already, with a cup of poisoned wine. The closer she came to Westeros, the more likely another attack became. Back in Carth, the warlock, Pyat Pree, had sent a sorrowful man after her to avenge the undying she'd burned in their house of dust. Warlocks never forgot a wrong, it was said, and the sorrowful men never failed to kill. Most of the Dothraki would be against her as well. Khal Drogo's coes led Khalasars of their own now, and none of them would hesitate to attack her own little band on sight, to slay and slave her people, and drag Danny back to Vaes Dothrak to take her proper place among the withered crones of the Dosh Kaleen. She hoped that Zaro Zoandaxis was not an enemy, but the Carthian merchant had coveted her dragons, and there was Quaith of the Shadow, that strange woman in the red lacquer mask, with all her cryptic counsel. Was she an enemy too, or only a dangerous friend? Danny could not say. Sir Jorah saved me from the poisoner, and Arsten Whitebeard from the manticore. Perhaps Strong Belwas will save me from the next. He was huge enough, with arms like small trees, and a great curved arrack so sharp he might have shaved with it, in the unlikely event of hair sprouting on those smooth brown cheeks. yet he was childlike as well. As a protector, he leaves much to be desired. Thankfully, I have Sejora and my blood riders, and my dragons, never forget. In time, the dragons would be her most formidable guardians, just as they had been for Aegon the Conqueror and his sisters 300 years ago. Just now, though, they brought her more danger than protection. In all the world there were but 3 living dragons, and those were hers. They were a wonder, and a terror, and beyond price. She was pondering her next words when she felt a cool breath on the back of her neck, and a loose strand of her silver-gold hair stirred against her brow. Above, the canvas creaked and moved, and suddenly a great cry went up from all over Beleriand. "Wind!" the sailors shouted. "The wind returns! The wind!" Danny looked up to where the great cog sails rippled and belled as the lines thrummed and tightened and sang the sweet song they had missed for 6 long days. Captain Grelio rushed aft, shouting commands. The Pentashi were scrambling up the masts, those that were not cheering. Even strong Belwus let out a great bellow and did a little dance. "The guards are good," Danny said. "You see, Jorah, we are on our way once more."
"Yes," he said. "But to what, my queen?"
All day the wind blew, steady from the east at first, and then in wild gusts. The sun set in a blaze of red. "I'm still half a world from Westeros," Danny reminded herself, "but every hour brings me closer." She tried to imagine what it would feel like when she first caught sight of the land she was born to rule. "It will be as fair a shore as I have ever seen. I know it. How could it be otherwise?" But later that night, as Beleriand plunged onward through the dark, and Danny sat cross-legged on her bunk in the captain's cabin, feeding her dragons.
"Even upon the sea," Grelio had said so graciously, "queens take precedence over captains."
A sharp knock came upon the door. Iri had been sleeping at the foot of her bunk. It was too narrow for 3, and tonight was Jiqui's turn to share the soft feather bed with her Khaleesi. But the handmaid roused at the knock and went to the door. Danny pulled up the coverlet and tucked it under her arms. She was naked and had not expected a caller at this hour. "Come," she said, when she saw Sejora standing without, beneath the swaying lantern. The exile knight ducked his head as he entered.
"Your Grace, I'm sorry to disturb your sleep."
"I was not sleeping, sir. Come and watch." She took a chunk of salt pork out of the bowl in her lap and held it up for her dragons to see. All 3 of them eyed it hungrily. Rhaegal spread green wings and stirred the air, and Viserion's neck swayed back and forth like a long pale snake's as he followed the movement of her hand. "Drogon," Danny said softly, "Dracaris," and she tossed the pork in the air. Drogon moved quicker than a striking cobra. Flame roared from his mouth, orange and scarlet and black, searing the meat before it began to fall. As his sharp black teeth snapped shut around it, Rhaegar's head darted close, as if to steal the prize from his brother's jaws. But Drogon swallowed and screamed, and the smaller green dragon could only hiss in frustration. "Stop that, Rhaegal," Danny said in annoyance, giving his head a swat. "You had the last one. I'll have no greedy dragons." She smiled at Sejora. "I won't need to char their meat over a brazier any longer."
"So I see. Dracaris?"
All 3 dragons turned their heads at the sound of that word, and Viserion let loose with a blast of pale gold flame that made Sejora take a hasty step backward. Danny giggled. "Be careful with that word, sir, or they'll like to singe your beard off. It means dragonfire in High Valyrian. I wanted to choose a command that no one was like to utter by chance." Mormont nodded.
"Your Grace," he said, "I wonder if I might have a few private words."
"Of course. Iri, leave us for a bit." She put a hand on Jiqui's bare shoulder and shook the other handmaid awake. "You as well, sweetling. Sir Jorah needs to talk to me."
"Yes, Khaleesi."
Jiqui tumbled from the bunk, naked and yawning. Her thick black hair tumbled about her head. She dressed quickly and left with Iri, closing the door behind them. Danny gave the dragons the rest of the salt pork to squabble over and patted the bed beside her. "Sit, good sir, and tell me what is troubling you."
"Three things," Sir Jorah sat. "Strong Belwas, this Arstin Whitebeard, and Illyrio Mopatus, who sent them."
"Again?" Danny pulled the coverlet higher and tugged one end over her shoulder. "And why is that?"
"The warlocks in Karth told you that you would be betrayed three times,"
the exile knight reminded her, as Viserion and Rhaegal began to snap and claw at each other. "Once for blood, and once for gold, and once for love." Danny was not like to forget. Miramaz Dur was the first.
"Which means two traitors yet remain. And now these two appear. I find that troubling, yes? Never forget, Robert offered a lordship to the man who slays you."
Danny leaned forward and yanked Viserion's tail to pull him off his green brother. Her blanket fell away from her chest as she moved. She grabbed it hastily and covered herself again. "The usurper is dead," she said.
"But his son rules in his place."
Sir Jorah lifted his gaze, and his dark eyes met her own.
"A dutiful son pays his father's debts, even blood debts."
"This boy Joffrey might want me dead, if he recalls that I'm alive. What has that to do with Belwas and Arstin Whitebeard? The old man does not even wear a sword. You've seen that."
"Aye, and I've seen how deftly he handles that staff of his. Recall how he killed that manticore in Karth? It might as easily have been your throat he crushed."
"Might have been, but was not," she pointed out. "It was a stinging manticore meant to slay me. He saved my life."
"Khaleesi, has it occurred to you that Whitebeard and Belwas might have been in league with the assassin? It might all have been a ploy to win your trust."
A sudden laughter made Drogon hiss and sent Viserion flapping to his perch above the porthole. The ploy worked well. The exile knight did not return her smile.
"These are Illyrio's ships, Illyrio's captains, Illyrio's sailors, and Strong Belwas and Arstan are his men as well, not yours."
"Magister Illyrio has protected me in the past. Strong Belwas says that he wept when he heard my brother was dead."
"Yes," said Mormont, "but did he weep for Viserys or for the plans he had made with him?"
"His plans need not change. Magister Illyrio is a friend of House Targaryen and wealthy."
"He was not born wealthy. In the world, as I have seen it, no man grows rich by kindness. The warlock said the second treason would be for gold. What does Illyrio Mopatus love more than gold?"
"His skin." Across the cabin, Drogon stirred restlessly, steam rising from his snout. "Miramaz Dur betrayed me. I burned her for it."
"Miramaz Dur was in your power. In Pentos, you should be in Illyrio's power. It's not the same. I know the Magister as well as you. He is a devious man and clever."
"I need clever men about me if I am to win the Iron Throne." Sir Jorah snorted.
"That wine-seller who tried to poison you was a clever man as well. Clever men hatch ambitious schemes."
Danny drew her legs up beneath the blanket. "You will protect me. You and my blood riders."
"Four men? Khaleesi, you believe you know Illyria Mopatis. Very well. Yet you insist on surrounding yourself with men you do not know, like this puffed-up eunuch and the world's oldest squire. Take a lesson from Pyat Pri and Zaro Zoan Dexus."
"He means well," Danny reminded herself. "He does all he does for love. It seems to me that a queen who trusts no one is as foolish
as a queen who trusts everyone. Every man I take into my service is a risk, I understand that. But how am I to win the Seven Kingdoms without such risks? Am I to conquer Westeros with